You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Donald Trump repeats his election claim that he'll reassess the US's relationship with NATO.
What do you think of NATO? Now you have to understand, I'm a business person. Number one, the 28 countries of NATO, many of them aren't paying their fair share. Number two, I said, and very strongly, NATO could be obsolete because they do not focus on terror.
My guests Tim Marshall and Rosemary Hollis will be discussing this and the day's other big stories, including why is France keen to bring together Israel and Palestine for talks when neither side seems that keen on turning up? We'll ask why Turkey's deputy prime minister is pointing the finger at foreign intelligence agencies when dealing with terror attacks in the country. And we'll ask why a new train from Serbia to Kosovo might derail the peace between the two neighbours. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Tim Marshall, foreign affairs analyst and editor of thewhatandthewhy.com, and Rosemary Hollis, professor of international politics at City University London. Tim and Rosemary, thank you for being here today.
Greetings.
Donald Trump has doubled down on his sceptical outlook towards NATO. In a joint interview with the Times of London and the German daily Bild, Trump repeated his campaign claim that NATO risks becoming obsolete. He said, "It's obsolete, first because it was designed many, many years ago, and secondly, countries aren't paying what they should." Trump also claims NATO didn't deal with terrorism. Tim Marshall, let's take that last thing first. NATO is a problem because it doesn't deal with terrorism. How do you think the families of the 1,000 plus soldiers, NATO soldiers, who lost their lives in Afghanistan after 9/11 might feel hearing that?
Not very good at all. But he's correct in that NATO doesn't do a great deal about terrorism. It's not a terrorism fighting force. It hasn't been redesigned to do that in this century. As for obsolete, I just think that what he says and what we hear are sometimes two different things. I mean, he may not even know what the word obsolete means in regard to.
Do you think what he's trying to say is there's a bit of a problem with it? It needs to change.
Yes, honestly, I mean, he doesn't bother to choose his words carefully, whereas we know that in international relations you need to. He's bringing the business model to international relations, and when he says it's obsolete, what I think he's trying to scare the NATO countries into ponying up more money. He even got the numbers wrong. He said there was 22 NATO countries. You know, he doesn't even know the right amount of countries that are in it. But I'm not that really concerned, because I don't think he does think it's obsolete. I think it's just he wants to modernize it. He wants to do this. He wants to do that. He wants everyone else to pay more money for it. I don't really think he's about to oversee the dismemberment of NATO. Your opening point, though, is correct. I mean, it is a bit of a slap for the families of the troops that fought under the NATO flag.
And Rosemary, you know, as Tim says, maybe he doesn't mean obsolete, but that's certainly what the Kremlin heard, and they issued a statement today saying that they support Donald Trump in believing that NATO is obsolete. And also, perhaps if you were listening to those statements in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, you might be also concerned by hearing that word obsolete.
Yeah, I know. But I think Tim has alluded to this fact that it depends what you read into what he's saying and whether it was designed to shake people up in a way that they feel is dangerous, that they're going to be abandoned, or because it is his style to shake everybody up by saying what, in his perception, should have been said years ago. At the end of the Cold War, there was a fairly serious debate about whether we needed NATO anymore. And classically, this sort of institutional inertia, it had taken so long to build up, the people who operated inside NATO were having far too good a time carrying on operating inside NATO. And it didn't have a serious reason for being. So they developed this agenda for out of NATO area operations. And we know that only some of them went to Libya, but this was a classic example of NATO being available for operations outside the Cold War theatre of operations. And I think the debate has never stopped, really. What's it for? And is it better to have an amalgam, an alliance of armed forces, than to go back to separate ones for each state? And since actually it's not an option to go back to separate ones, because so many states, including the UK, can't operate by themselves. They've got to be within an alliance to do anything halfway decent in terms of formal military operations. It's a sort of circular debate that's not going to go anywhere.
Tim, there is an argument that post-89 NATO was an alliance in search of a problem.
Yes.
But
In search of a role, yes.
In search of a role, yes. But NATO may argue that actually they've adapted fairly well over the past 30 years. They can say, look, we made a difference in Bosnia and in Kosovo. We made a difference in Afghanistan. They might talk about Libya. They might talk about that a little less at the moment, but they might. They might also talk about what they're trying to do in Ukraine in a sort of careful-ish way. And now we're in a situation where, with Russia acting as it is in Ukraine and on the borders of those Baltic states I mentioned before, that, as Rosemary says, maybe there is a debate to be had about the point of NATO, but maybe now actually isn't the time.
Oh, I've just thought that actually Trump is not the first to invent this, because if you remember when George W. came in, he was not going to do any more, and Rumsfeld weren't going to do any more alliance wars.
And then history caught up with them, and now history has caught up with Russia, the Russia-NATO debate again, because everybody always fights the last war. The NATO decided after 89 it would become more flexible and less made of iron, with fewer tanks and things. And then it wanted to be more agile. And it's funny because they're now actually a few years behind again. And because they've seen what's happening in Russia, and this started pretty much from the invasion of Georgia, they realized, oh, okay, maybe the Cold War is coming back. And then after Ukraine, maybe the Cold War is back. And they're now trying to re-engineer NATO away from the light and flexible and go back to the heavy, because they realize they may be facing off against the Russian army on the plains of Europe. Now, probably not. But is NATO obsolete? They don't think that in Georgia. They're desperate to join it. They don't think that in Ukraine. They absolutely don't feel it in Poland, in Romania, in the Baltic states. The UK doesn't think it's obsolete. The French and the Germans don't think it's obsolete. So, and I don't really think he does. I think he throws these words out of there. And by the way, Rex Tillerson, his incoming Secretary of State, when he gave evidence to the Senate last week, he doesn't think it's obsolete either.
And nor does James Mattis, exactly, the Defence Secretary candidate as well.
It's an opening gambit, if you think about it. It's like
everything he does, it's an opening gambit. He's kicking the car tyres.
Well, exactly. Well, I want to come on to a couple of the other things that he's talked about before. And actually in this interview, what was interesting was, on some of these things, what he didn't say. So, for example, he was pushed on, well, will you move the US embassy from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv? And he didn't say yes again, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He said, well, maybe we'll see about that. He was asked about the Iran deal, and he said, well, it was a terrible, terrible deal. But when he was pushed a little bit on, are you going to sort of, pull it apart again, he didn't say yes. Rosemary,
we're talking about this interview by Michael Gove as well as the German journalist, right?
New Times newspaper today.
But don't you think that in itself was an interesting phenomenon? I mean, it's absolutely riddled with politics. What was Michael Gove up to?
Well, indeed, let's get away from what Michael Gove is up to, because otherwise we'll be here all day on a very different topic. But Rosemary, you mentioned about him talking about the opening gambit. He makes these statements and then perhaps sort of rows back a bit. Do you see those two things on, not moving from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, perhaps not reopening the Iran deal? It was his way before of saying, this is what I think, but in office he might do something different.
Well, you could be correct that that's the logic behind what he had to say on those two occasions, on those two issues. I think the fact that his son-in-law sees himself as having a bit of a mission on the Middle East should give us all pause. And who knows, he might have said, don't go in all guns blazing. We're already on the winning side here in terms of the Israelis having things pretty much sewn up. They just need permission to do it. Now, actually, that would take us to the Paris conference with other people saying that they need to send a message that Trump will be forging ahead on an issue without everybody else behind him in the international community if he wants to be hardline pro-Israel and anti-Palestinian.
We'll come on to the Paris talks in just a moment. But Tim, just finally on this interview, one of the things that the British press have ignored because they're just cock-a-hoop that there might be some sort of trade deal. But one of the things that I thought was most striking about this was the language he used about Angela Merkel and talking about her, her catastrophic decisions. Let's leave aside the fact that he referred to all refugees as illegals and his language on that. But the way that he was openly criticising one of the US's biggest allies, and then not only that, then putting her on a par with Vladimir Putin, saying, I will trust both of them to start with and then we'll see what happens. What did you make of that?
I think that all bets are off, and that's what he's saying to everybody. He's got everybody rattled. The phone call from Taiwan, was not a blunder by a man who doesn't know what he's doing. The phone call from Taiwan was to get right under the Chinese skin, and he's done it. He's done it with everybody, and it's working. Now,
But in what way is it working? It's one thing if you get your supposed enemies rattled, but I'm looking at Europe now. Russia's not rattled. Germany is rattled, and Russia's not.
I think Russia is quietly nervous about this unknown entity arriving. I think he's pretty made it plain, and he's slapped back Mrs. Merkel because after his outbursts, which are so many, which are intemperate, she was then lauded as the sort of like social conscience of Europe, and he's come back at her again. He's just sticking it out to everyone. He's an American nationalist, but let me we mustn't look at and hear what he says through the prism of most people's dislike for him. As if you do that, you don't really hear it. Let me give you two little examples. He at no point has ever said he's going to build a wall for every single inch of the Mexican border. He's got a lovely wall, a beautiful wall. But he knows that a lot of it is river, some of it's mountains. Mm. If he can put just a little bit of fence up, he only needs about a 5-foot wall for the TV cameras to look at. And it'll be job done.
Yeah, I'm not talking about this. I know what you're getting. But this idea that that we here take him literally, yes, but not seriously, absolutely, and his supporters take him seriously but not literally. Fine, but let's take him either literally or seriously when it comes to the way he talks about Russia and the way he talks about Germany, putting them on a par, putting those leaders on a par, hardly saying a word of criticism against Vladimir Putin.
Well, wait
that
a minute.
To worry.
What did about the possibility, if you're in the rough and tumble of the business world and you want to unsettle your competition right from the word go? It's a classic technique. You throw them a low blow or a side swipe, something that they're not expecting, and they're so focused on that.
I get that, but why is Germany
well, why
the
are
opposition?
Why are we hanging on to trying to be serious and debate in old-fashioned style some of the issues he brought up?
That's the point. We are looking at it in the old way. He is moving in the new way. Now, over the 4 years, I don't know if it's going to work, but I do know this is the new way. And you've got to look beyond that bluster.
I accept the new way, but my point remains, it's, if you want to undermine or make nervous the people that are your perceived enemies, that's one thing. He's not doing that. He is making everyone nervous.
The only thing he cares about, apart from Donald Trump, is America.
Yeah.
I don't think he has a hoot about. Well, the Brits, he probably has this sort of residual
of his
affection.
Mum and the Queen.
His mum loves the Queen. He doesn't care about Germany. I don't really think he cares about Israel either. In fact, already, I don't think they necessarily will now move the embassy. Last one.
He won't be the first president-elect to say so.
Every single one has said they're going to move it. It's on the statute books, and then they never do. Last one, very briefly, he did say about banning all Muslims, and, you know, and everyone thought, what a nutter. He has, in the interview today, he talks now about extreme vetting from places that have terrorism. He's shifting and he's throwing everybody off balance. I don't like the guy. I don't know if it's going to be success, but I think he is playing what could be a very clever game, and at the moment I think he's winning it.
Okay, we'll move on. Yesterday saw representatives from more than 70 nations gather in Paris in an attempt to restart talks between Israel and Palestine regarding a potential two-state solution. However, the leaders of Israel and indeed Palestine weren't actually there. Mahmoud Abbas and Benjamin Netanyahu gave the event a miss. Netanyahu called it a relic, and many other critics labelling it pointless. So, Rosemary, what was France hoping to achieve by hosting this when it seems as if the people who were most concerned with this issue don't really want to be there?
I don't think they were intended to be there. I think it was for the sake of France and other Western players who have been in distress for many, many years now, that actually that whatever they say, they are unable to do something to end this conflict. And as I recollect from about 10 years ago, when I was doing some work for some senior figures in the European Union on this conflict, and I said, but it's so obvious that a resolution of this conflict would be in the European interests, and was told by a former commissioner, we've been saying that for years, it doesn't mean that we solve it. And I came to the conclusion that everybody wants it solved, provided they don't have to do any heavy lifting to get it solved. That's one. So they have to keep repeating that it's needs solving, but they don't have the gumption or the will to do something about it, especially if they would suffer a cost. But the other thing that's going on, which actually is important in this new era that we've just been talking about, is to lay down a marker again, as was done with John Kerry after the UN vote about this conflict. What is, under international law, illegal? And if they don't keep reminding themselves of that, then all ballast, all sources of reference points go down the swanny. I mean, you just throw out the rule book. And as a matter of fact, the Israelis have done this, and their judges have pointed out how serious that is. It was the official Israeli position from 1967 under Israeli law that they were a power in occupation of the West Bank, which has all sorts of implications for how the law applies. Latterly, Netanyahu and other politicians have overturned that and said, we are not in occupation. Now, the lawyers and the people who try to stick to the rules that we all believe help us operate don't know how to handle this. Because if it's all up for grabs, if it's all a matter of the opinion of the government in power, we really are at sea.
Tim, part of the problem here is that if anyone is going to use Trump's words, make a beautiful deal, they need to have political capital and they need to be willing to spend it. And, you know, Rosemary talks about laying down a marker. What we've seen over the last, you know, 20 years is that Democratic administrations in the US are very good at laying down a marker just as they're running out the door.
Yeah, and that's happened again. Mr. Kerry was there today, utterly powerless, hopeless. There was nothing going to come out of this Paris conference. I do agree with Rosemary about the idea about legality, because it was in the final communique out of Paris, this thing about this is occupied territory. And the way, you know, because the Americans recently abstained at the UN on a pretty important vote. That is important, but you could have done that with a round-robin email. I think it's the same tired old people going to the same hotels in the chauffeur-driven limousines with their spouses going shopping, getting absolutely nowhere, and it's froth and nonsense where they all come up with their great communiques and they speak very grandly and very proudly. It was a vanity project by an outgoing failed socialist president, Monsieur Hollande. Two far more important meetings have happened in the last week. Well, one. One, Fatah and Hamas met together in Beirut to try to come together ahead of national elections sometime this year. If they can achieve that and achieve that unity, that is a far more meaningful thing in the great narrative of this struggle. The other more important meeting is the Palestinian factions going to Moscow this week. Not only are they now looking for a different interlocutor, but also the Russians, having planted themselves back in the Middle East in Syria, are now going to try and make themselves indispensable on the world stage when it comes to Palestine and Israel. Those two meetings, which got no headlines, are far more important than this froth in Paris.
And I would like to see how you square the triangle between the Trump administration with what we keep hearing, his enthusiasm for the Russian administration and his enthusiasm for the Israeli hard line. If Russia's going to have the Palestinian factions to tea, where is this leading? I mean, it's another of the fascinating twists and turns to who's allied with who.
I call it the age of uncertainty, because really things have changed in the past year.
And what's striking, Tim, is how quickly they can change. Yeah. So, for example, you know, if you were to look at Syria peace talks, which, you know, John Kerry has been a leading figure in these failed talks over the past few years, and it's all about Kerry and Lavrov and trying to get a deal and let's go to Geneva. And then suddenly, you know, we've had talks in Astana, yeah, in Kazakhstan, yeah, sorted out by the Russians that the Americans weren't even invited
to. It's in flux. Look, I mean, I spent years and years being relatively confident that you can sketch out the future and you can just predict things and get 7 out of 10 and think you've done okay, 7 out of 10 things right. At the moment, it is far, far harder to see round the corner, over the mountain, to see where things are going. And I've never known a time like it. You know, I'm not some old git banging on saying, oh, things aren't what they used to be and it was always better. I've always been very, very positive. But just right now, over the past 1 to 2 years, it is so mixed up and so in flux and so contradictory, where a country does one thing and then it does something else. And the two things seem to contradict each other. And we're all trying to make some sense of it at the moment.
Okay, let's take a quick pause. When we're back, we'll talk about Turkey. We'll also talk about Kosovo and Serbia. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
What is culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows. There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fistfights. And everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there? Well, when we're not enjoying the after party, we're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like, how do you adapt a novel? And how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair, and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
You're listening to Midori House. Still with me are Tim Marshall and Rosemary Hollis. Turkey's Deputy Prime Minister Numan Kurtulmuş has said that the mass shooting that took place at an Istanbul nightclub on New Year's Eve, killing 39 people, involved an outside intelligence agency. The attack has been claimed by Islamic State. The Deputy Prime Minister said has not named which agency he might be referring to. Rosemary, in recent weeks we've talked about how the pro-government press in Turkey is always seeing the Americans, and in particular the CIA, behind everything. Kurtulmuş didn't say America, didn't say the CIA, but that's what he's inferring, isn't it?
I'm not sure, but it's a fair bet to say some intelligence agency was involved in almost anything. They should be across the story, if nothing else. And the basis upon which the Turks are pointing fingers at the Americans is because allegedly the CIA had some advanced knowledge that this was going to happen at the nightclub, the shooting at the nightclub.
I think they had advanced knowledge that something was going to happen, yeah, at some stage, in that way the embassies say.
The owner of the nightclub had been told the week before, look, you know, your club may well be a target, and he was thinking about closing it. So that, yeah, but in the sort of like general warning.
In the general sort of, well, there are places that we're worried about.
And this is normal. I am more interested in trying to figure out why it is there's such enthusiasm, including in America, and certainly in the Western media, to have a go at Turkey. It's almost like a cheap shot, because the Turks are in the middle of nothing fundamentally different from what's going on in America and in Britain in terms of a completely divided society.
But sorry, just on this issue, that trying to...
Well, you blame others in a situation like that. If you're in a national crisis...
I know, but blaming America for being behind an ISIS attack?
Well, this is like hanging on to the idea that Turkey's a NATO ally of the United States. Yes, Turkey was an extremely important NATO ally of the United States. But as of the US decision to invade Iraq in 2003, the Turks have not played ball under Erdogan with everything that the Americans want. And so it's a bit of an old story.
Tim, do you share Rosemary's view there?
No. I think there are myriad reasons to criticise the current administration in Turkey and the measures it's taking, despite it being in a really, really tough place with a lot of terrorist acts and a deeply divided society. I still think they're going way, way over the top. And I think this is part of it. I think the Turks are now falling into that self-defeating trap that most of the Arab nations and indeed culture has, which is always, always seeing the hidden hand. They're all out to get us. We mighty Turks, the world doesn't like us. I think that's where this statement about, oh, there's some intelligence agency. This looks probably was a Daesh ISIS operation. They claimed it. Doesn't mean it was them. They claimed it. And I just think this is part of Turkish politics where you do what the Egyptians always do. Oh, the hidden hand of the outsider.
Look, the Kurdish population, minority of the Turkish population, if they cannot live in peace with the Turks in Turkey, then the country's days are numbered. And it is true that the United States befriended the Kurds in Iraq first and then in
Syria. But
that
also works both ways,
doesn't
it?
And supplied them with weapons in order to take on ISIS. And the Turks were less worried traditionally, even about ISIS than about the Kurds, because they are a threat to the national cohesion of the country. It's like if the Americans, I beg your pardon, if the Mexicans decided to take back Texas and half of California, it's not going to happen in the United States. But in Turkey, because of developments just south of its border, there are some very serious trends that threaten the unity of the country and the future of the country.
But on that point, Tim, that works both ways. It's, you know, yes, there are Kurds in the southeast of the country that want autonomy and have used violence.
I'm with Rosemary.
There was a peace process that was happening.
I'm with Rosemary on the existential threat. There is an existential threat to the Turkish nation. I agree with everything that Rosemary just said. The only thing, I mean, we're talking about this particular thing where the Deputy Prime Minister is talking about a foreign intelligence agency. I think he is simply scaremongering and using the hidden hand. That's the only thing that we disagree on, perhaps.
But also, he may have been putting out a feeler to, in hopes that the Trump administration will not be so lily-livered about human rights.
Okay, we'll move on. Briefly, for the last couple of minutes, let's talk about trains. Well, sort of about trains. It's about more than that. Serbia has covered a train service destined for its neighbour Kosovo in Serbian colours and adorned it with the slogan, Kosovo is Serbia. Kosovo won independence from Serbia in 2008, is understandably not happy about it. The train was stopped at the Kosovo border to protect the country's sovereignty, said Kosovo's Prime Minister Isa Mustafa. Tim, you covered the Kosovo war. What's going on here?
Kosovo did not win independence. It declared independence, and Serbia doesn't recognise it, and nor do several European countries do declare it. Right, what this is about is that it is deep in the Serb nationalist heart. That is the cradle of their civilization. They have lost it. Lo and behold, there's an election coming up in April in Serbia. The president is a nationalist. He's not doing too well. So his nationalistic government, that I remember during the Milosevic years were actually close to being fascists, have decided that the first train for years to go down into Kosovo from Serbia will be bedecked with 21 languages written across the trains outside. Kosovo is Serbia. I mean, if that's not inflammatory, I don't know what is. Of course, they knew it would never be allowed to go through Kosovo. So it is stopped by the Kosovans, at which point the Serbs Serbs get to say, this is terrible, and you can have a nice big row about it, get your nationalist fervour really, really going up ahead of the April election. The next flashpoint, I've just got off the phone to a friend in Belgrade, the next flashpoint, January the 21st, when there's supposed to be a bridge opening in Mitrovica in the north of Kosovo. It's politics.
And also, it sort of, Rosemary, it sort of works for the Kosovans as well, doesn't it? The same sort of nationalistic politics.
Well, I'm no expert whatsoever on the nitty-gritty of what's going on there. But I do observe from a distance a sort of classic piece of behaviour, which is, you know, stir something up if you want to detract attention from another concern.
Tim, why then, just briefly, is there a train line and a bridge when when no one actually wants it to go wants it to happen?
Because once upon a time it was all part of Yugoslavia, then it was all part of Serbia, and then they split into two, Kosovo and Serbia. So of course there is a bridge and a link and trade and all the rest of it. And if they could have just buried their differences, easily said, then perhaps they could be more successful. But no, it's an irredentist issue for each side.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Tim Marshall, Rosemary Hollis, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Geriot. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next. Then at 1900, it's Culture with Robert Bound. Do tune in to that. The Daily's back at 2200. Midori House back same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.